You're listening to LawPod UK from the creators of the UK Human Rights Blog. It's a podcast that discusses developments across all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All the comments are current at the time of podcast publication. In this podcast, we're bringing you another highlight from One Crown Office Row's 2018 seminar, Truth, Justice and Accountability, Modern Challenges of Major Inquests and Inquiries. One Crown Office Row's Emma Louise Fenlon talked about secrecy, anonymity and public information.
There was a very impressive report that came out in December 2017 that was authored by Emma Norris and Marcus Shepherd on behalf of the Institute for Government. And they estimated that of the 68 public inquiries that have begun since 1990, these have taken on average 2.5 years to report. And further, they found that 9 inquiries took longer than 5 years. Hopefully what will become apparent during the course of this particular review is that matters of secret and sensitive information form a significant part of that work and are some of the reasons why these public inquiries take as long as they do. In preparing this talk, I thought it would be helpful to canvass members of chambers with significantly more experience than I have in public inquiries, and so I did a round of the House and was helpfully pointed to many resources that have been very helpful. And so I refer, of course, to the Inquests book by Garnham and Cross and Public Inquiries by Jason Beer QC. In addition, I asked Amy Mannion for some assistance, and she helpfully pointed me to a summary of the various principles that are involved in restriction orders. And the summary document went as long as 83 pages, which is an indication of how enormous this subject is and is one of the reasons why this will touch upon some of the issues that are thrown up, particularly in recent public inquiries, but cannot seek to even skate over every aspect of this topic. Obviously, the presumption is that public inquiries and inquests will take place in public. And often this is described as openness and transparency in many of the texts. At paragraph 5 of my paper, I use the word publicness because I don't think openness and transparency really covers the importance that these actually happen in public. And I think that point, in my view, is most persuasively argued by Judge Mason of the High Court of Australia when he said in 1982, "By virtue of the publicity which usually attends the proceedings, and ultimately the report when it is made public, the Commission of Inquiry serves the beneficial purpose of enlightening the public just as it enlightens government." And I think it's interesting there that he uses government with a small g. It's about how we are governed rather than the government. And I think that that's a role that major inquests and public inquiries play. In terms of the production of evidence, obviously the Inquiries Act gives the chairman or chairwoman enormous powers to compel provision of documents, evidence, witness testimony, and the like. And this is subject to many restrictions, not all of which I could go into, but obviously those will include duties of confidence, privilege against self-incrimination, legal professional privilege, public interest immunity, and parliamentary privilege. But in addition to these, the presumption that a public inquiry will proceed in public is subject to other constraints. And these are imposed by restriction notices or restriction orders. The Inquiries Act outlines a number of permissible grounds for these to be made. Some of these are mandatory. So, for example, when a statute, EU obligation or rule of law requires it, a restriction order must be made. However, when a restriction appears conducive to the inquiry investigation or is necessary in the public interest, the decision involves a balancing exercise, having regard in particular but not exclusively to some of the matters that are outlined in the Inquiries Act. And many inquiries these days publish protocols and the like to try and parse what the woolly statement public interest really means. This has happened in particular in the undercover policing inquiry, when in 2016 the chairman of that inquiry published a ruling stating exactly what he was talking about when he spoke about public interest. And so he said that matters to consider include, for example, the source and nature of possible harm to police officers, the identification of those who may be harmed, medical evidence on which an officer relies, the existence and quantification of any pre-existing risk of harm, the means other than a restriction order that may be available to avoid or reduce the risk of harm, and whether and the extent to which those means would, without the restriction order, avoid or reduce the risk. So that's obviously helpful when restriction orders are being made. The issue, of course, in the undercover policing inquiry, as has been reported, is that the volume of restriction orders has slowed things down somewhat. And in order to alleviate that issue, a consultation paper sought the views of the participants on how the process might be sped up. The issue from the non-police and non-state participants is that unilateral applications for anonymity mean that without them seeing the evidence, they are in fact unable to make meaningful submissions. And while I'm sure the chairman took this on board, he streamlined the process nonetheless. And this precipitated, as I'm sure many of you read, a walkout by non-police and non-state core participants. It's interesting that despite all of the media coverage of issues to do with anonymity and disclosure, no judicial review has successfully yet been brought to actually challenge this ruling, and none has been brought successfully or unsuccessfully challenging any anonymity order. One of the ideas canvassed by the chairman of the Undercover Policing Inquiry was the idea of a confidentiality circle, but it was considered, and the idea is that witnesses could potentially have been disclosed relevant information subject on terms as to confidentiality. So the idea would be it would be private, but not necessarily secret. And this has been considered before. And ultimately, the chairman of the Undercover Policing Inquiry decided against this. It just wouldn't be workable. And he stated, "In my view, it is unrealistic to suppose that disclosure to a limited circle would answer the practical problem faced by the inquiry. If, for example, the inquiry traced witnesses with a view to disclosing the cover name of an undercover officer, it would have no advance knowledge whether the witness would be prepared to receive information on terms of confidentiality." And he goes on, "Even if the witness undertook to keep the information confidential, the inquiry could not guarantee that the confidentiality would be kept or that inadvertent disclosure would not be made. If a leak did take place, given the constant interest and exposure of undercover police officers, it would be virtually impossible to trace its source." What I found interesting was that in the cases where this has been considered previously, it had been canvassed that the solicitor and counsel involved in the cases would undergo developed vetting in order to sit in a private setting, but not a closed session. The leading case on anonymity applications is, of course, Ray Officer L and others. But the test was laid out by the House of Lords in that case, and it is as follows. The state must take appropriate steps to safeguard the lives of those within its jurisdiction. When authorities know or ought to know of a real and immediate risk to the life of an identified individual, there is a positive obligation on the state to take reasonable preventative measures. The real risk to which the European Court of Human Rights referred is one that is objectively verified, and an immediate risk is present and continuing. The threshold for real and immediate risk is constant and not variable according to the type of act contemplated. And I think most significantly, the subjective fear of the applicant does not form part of the test, but it may be evidentially relevant in identifying the risk. I think the more interesting question that arises from that particular case is the fact that the state is required to take reasonable preventative measures, but that by its nature involves a balancing exercise. And therefore, the question has been posed, though never answered on specific facts in a case, but the question has been posed, could there be instances where the duty to carry out the functions of a chairman requires that, notwithstanding the fact that an Article 2 threshold is met, anonymity should not be granted? And this came up in Ray MacDonald's application for judicial review in 2015. The case concerned prison officers and their use of restraint and force when apprehending a prisoner. And following the inquest verdict, where it was found that unreasonable force had been used, the deceased's mother applied to have the anonymity of the prison officers vacated. And in that case, this idea of balancing and whether or not a balance could be appropriate was considered. And the Court of Appeal of Northern Ireland noted the observations of Lord Carswell on this point in Ray Officer L, where he had said, "It's possible, but I'd rather not decide." And the Court of Appeal held that such a balancing exercise may indeed be necessary. The chair of the Undercover Policing Inquiry recently reviewed these authorities in the ruling on restriction orders. and I think quite properly reminded us all that it would have to be a very compelling public interest indeed that prevented a statutory inquiry from imposing a restriction whose effect would be to avoid or reduce a real and immediate threat to life by exposure of a witness's identity, given, of course, the unqualified nature of Article 2 and Article 3. Another issue that has come up in relation to secret and sensitive information is, of course, the use of ciphers. But in particular, this became an issue in the independent inquiry into child sexual abuse. And it's not necessarily, the issue of ciphers is not necessarily straightforward, because obviously they're routinely used to allow reference to anonymous individuals. However, the chairwoman of the inquiry indicated that generally persons in authority, so for example, headmasters, housemasters, would not have their names redacted. However, those who had been accused of child, either physical or sexual abuse, would have their names redacted. And you can imagine that there has been some overlap in those two positions. And it becomes complicated because to refer to, for example, a housemaster by cipher makes that person within a small number of people who are readily identified by jigsaw identification. And of course, if you are referring, for example, to a headmaster by cipher, it becomes plain instantly who you're speaking to as soon as you know the year that he held the post. This led to Riel Sharmi-Jones addressing the inquiry on this and trying to outline the approach that the inquiry would take. And though she acknowledged that certainly the representatives on behalf of Ampleforth and Downside Abbey in the English Benedictine Congregation module had serious issues and concerns about the use of ciphers, she reiterated that often context and understanding somebody's role was important when that had a bearing on an institution's response. So if, for example, somebody turned around and told a headmaster or a housemaster about abuse, the fact that that person might also have been subject to allegations themselves becomes relevant, as you can imagine. What was also helpful in the independent inquiry into child sexual abuse was the fact that a 3-minute delay had been put on the feed. So frequently, whenever any of these issues came up, the live feed could be stopped and a restriction order was then made immediately on the hoof. Matt alerted me to a further issue that may arise in relation to ciphers and the Kingsmill massacre inquest. That inquest concerns the death of 10 Protestant workmen in 1976. They were taken off a minibus and gunned down. The families of those killed have tried to argue that following the High Court's decision in January regarding the Birmingham pub bombings, and in particular the quashing the decision of the coroner that the alleged perpetrators of the Birmingham pub bombings would not be part of the framework, that decision suggested that the suspects in the inquest in Northern Ireland no longer were entitled to anonymity. And what will be interesting to see is, when any conclusion is reached, is it possible, or could it be possible, that a conclusion might actually refer to individuals by cipher? Finally, in relation to evidence in inquests, I will touch briefly on some of the reasons why an inquiry becomes necessary. Since the introduction of the 2009-2013 statutory scheme, a coroner's powers are now significantly enhanced to where they were previously. They can now compel evidence and, in particular, witness testimony. They are still, however, limited because it's not possible for an inquest to be held in the absence of interested persons. And so it means that secret information cannot be considered, notwithstanding massive campaigns on behalf of various governments to try and introduce those. So this means that where a coroner considers that his duty can no longer be carried out because he is limited to the evidence that he is capable of seeing, an inquiry becomes necessary. And this has happened in the case of Azel Rodney, Alexander Litvinenko, and Anthony Granger. In the case of Litvinenko, following a successful claim for public interest immunity brought by the Foreign Secretary, certain evidence was to be excluded from the inquest. Coroner was of the view that he couldn't continue without this evidence and therefore asked for an upgrade, essentially. The Secretary of State refused, and her decision was challenged by way of a judicial review brought by Mr. Litvinenko's widow. But on the question of whether or not a chairman of an inquiry would be able to state anything useful about the secret evidence that he or she had viewed. Lord Justice Richard said the following: "It is extremely difficult to envisage a situation in which no conclusion could be stated publicly without infringing a restriction notice. All this applies even more forcefully in relation to an inquiry of the kind sought by the coroner, which would look at all the open evidence, as well as the closed material, not only increasing the chances that some useful finding could be made, but also making it that much easier to express conclusions without revealing the closed material. The proposition a statutory inquiry would be incapable of achieving any useful purpose is therefore, in my view, a bad one." And of course, this was borne out in the inquiry chair's conclusions, where he stated, "Taking full account of all the evidence and analysis available to me, I find that the FSB operation to kill Litvinenko was probably approved by Mr. Patrushev and also by President Putin." But I think it's clear that these knotty issues form an enormous part of the work of inquiries, and in particular major public inquiries. And obviously the fact that on average they take 2.5 years to report illustrates that. Thank you.